Okay, thank you. We had some time for people to phrase a couple of questions or discussion before the recording session. Part of the call begins. Thanks for the participation. Hello, hi. Mitzur Lushoni Meiros Fasari. Nidal Bian Mirmavlan Kalalai Nafshi Sidom Nafshi Kiyom Fala Kol. Tihia. There's a beautiful part of the White Book. I don't speak for SA on this call. This is a Guard Your Eyes call. I happen to be a member of SA, which is why I'm in recovery. I can't imagine I would have gotten sober and gotten anything remotely like the recovery that I was given by God as a gift, one day at a time, through Guard Your Eyes. I know how much of a tremendous impact meetings and working steps with real-life people and looking into the eyes of other people who really believe in God instead of talked about the Rabbani Shalalim and et cetera and the Torah and blah, 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 who just believed in a simple relationship with their higher power. How powerful that is to me. How serious they take it and how real it is and what that did to me and does to me on a daily basis. And how it affects in a beautiful and very positive and I think beautiful way my Yiddishkeit and my relationship with my people, my family and children, my wife, my children, and et cetera, and how I see myself, how much more positively and more, it's a powerful positive force in my life and how I see myself. And I never worked a day, thank God, on self-esteem. Because like I described before, that self-esteem is, it's a trick to me. To me, it's just a trick. It's a trick to feed my pride. I don't need that fed. The reason that people that I know suffer usually from self-esteem troubles is because of this this silly image that we hold in our minds of how great we're supposed to be, and therefore we feel like failures. And if we were a little more realistic, we'd realize that it's not an accurate picture of ourselves. We're really mediocre in most things. We don't really have the giant role in things that we think we do. And now, with that perspective, we'll be able to become truly great, because now we'll have the objectivity and the calmness to accept the true gifts that the Rabbanu Shalom has given us and choose the way of living that that the Rabbanu Shalom wants for us. And that will bring us to great things. And Baruch Hashem, I see that in people's lives who are in recovery. We never, by accepting humility, we never downgrade ourselves. We never become losers. We never become failures. You know, people in recovery are so, because of this humility and because of dropping this pride that destroys our self-esteem, by the way, it destroys your self-esteem to have pride, because it makes a person, makes you, me, and everybody who's got this pride and arrogance of, I'm supposed to be the Rosh Yeshiva, really, and I don't get the covet I deserve. It kills us. It kills us. It makes us so depressed and have such low self, quote-unquote, self-esteem as a result, because we feel like failures. Getting rid of that, letting it go, which is acceptance, which is what the past few calls have been about, that acceptance brings a person to be able to be in unison with the Rabbanu Shalom's will for them, instead of me having a will for myself. And all those Musar Shmuzin that pushed me to have this ambition for myself of greatness and this and that, they've been tricking me as an addict. They've been fooling me and tricking me, twisting me into a person, and you and everybody who's got it, twisting a person. This she'ifus is a trick. It twists a person into always looking at themselves as a failure. This is why Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, used to say that these books about Gedolim and the lives of tzaddikim destroy generations of children. It rips the heart out of generations of children because it teaches them a falsehood that these people were all born great and that you can never do that. And yet it puts them up as a model for what you should be. It puts them up as a model that of like an unachievable, impossible thing, which is the same thing as fooling myself, that I can't accept mediocrity in anything. It's a guaranteed destruction of a human being. And for that one person who succeeds and becomes great in some way because of this tremendous push to be the greatest you can be, because you are, and it's not worth it for the ruba de ruba of people who end up killing themselves. You know, when I learned in Eretz Yisrael for 2 years, came back to America, and it felt like such a loser as a result. And so many other people have told me that they relate completely to that. When I came back to America, I had felt like I stepped down tremendously, and I really should be there instead of here. I felt like I had given up an olam. Like I felt like if Rabbi Lozner and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai had walked out of their cave, now they would have burned me up immediately every moment, every waking moment of my life. You know, I felt like a loser. You know, not like a loser, a loser. I felt like a loser, and it's because of the arrogance. It's because of this false expectation in myself that so many people think is she'ifus nechona. It's godless adam. That's slobodka. No, it's not. That's not slobodka. That's not the message of slobodka versus nevarta. Godless adam versus, you know, whatever, shiftless adam. No. That's not. That's arrogance. Back in the early 20th century, 1900, early 1900s, when Slobodka around the turn of the century, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when Slobodka and, you know, Kalam and Slobodka and all these things were developing in this, that was godless Adam. If you take a place like Slobodka in the way that they had Slobodka back then and you transplant it to America, let's say, or the 21st century here in our society, it would be rampant arrogance. It would convert into rampant arrogance. You would have to bring someone like Yosef Yoizel or someone like the Altar of Kelim in, someone like those two men. You'd have to bring them into the group and help them save the group, because it would turn into rampant arrogance instead of what it's meant to be. The Godless Adam message is completely different. But that having been said, there's some beautiful things that it says in the white book. One of the things that it says in the white book is lust kills love, and love kills lust. Two things Roy wrote in the white book that SA members read and talk about, you know, and try to see whether it's true in their lives. And people on Guard Your Eyes, you know, and everywhere else want to do what they want to do. We all want to do what we're comfortable with. That's what we are. Noach Weinberg used to say that all the time. The opposite of happiness isn't sadness. It's a focus. It's making comfort my priority. If I make comfort my priority, then I stymie my ability to achieve true happiness. Because the focus on comfort, the making comfort a priority, is I'm not comfortable with that idea. You know, I'm just not comfortable with that idea. I'm not ready for that idea. If that's the way that I always function, if that's my knee-jerk reaction to new ideas, to concepts that don't seem to fit with me, etc., things that let's say a therapist or a program person or a Rebbe suggests that I try to do. Well, I'm not comfortable with that. Well, you know, you have to do what you're comfortable with. And then everybody on Oprah, you know, starts cheering, you know, everybody on them, you know, on these, you know, like, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, you know, they'll start cheering for us. You know, that's exactly what we need to avoid if we want to really achieve happiness, Reb Noach used to say. Comfort, focus on comfort. Priority is, you know, being comfort. That's the opposite of happiness. And it's a, and you can look it up in his talks, and if you want to understand it, the Beharchava, you know, a little bit better. And I will too, because I'd like to as well. So Roy writes, so I mean, accepting an idea first is, you know, because it's comfortable to me, is not that it's not going to work. It's just not going to work in if I need to change. If I don't need to change, yes, I have that luxury, okay? I have that luxury of only doing things that I'm comfortable with. But if I don't have to change, if I'm not screwed up, then, you know, I it's not a wise course. Now the 12 steps, the big book writes at the end, this book is meant to be suggestive only. So we people who are using the 12 steps and reading these books and you know, sharing our stuff are not, unfortunately, since many of us are religious people, we end up sharing these things in a religious way, which means this is the right thing. You've got to believe this. You've got to agree. You need this, you know, and we're wrong. Most people don't need it. Most people are not addicts. If most people would be addicts, you know, the world would be very, very dysfunctional, even much, I mean, it's pretty dysfunctional, but it would be much more dysfunctional than it is. Because in general, even in Israel, quite a dysfunctional country, things work, you know, a lot of things work, you know, there's a lot of things that work. There are problems with everything, but most things function, you know. Anyhow. So obviously, you know, most people are not addicts, but those of us who are, like me, we learn that if we want to succeed, so then we need to kind of run from what's comfortable to me. And a lot of people find that insulting because our arrogance, I believe, tells us, my arrogance, I believe, tells me that, wants to tell me that, if I don't quite understand it, if I disagree with it based on some of my experience and this and that, then, you know, I feel averse to it now. It's like, ooh, you know, that's not right. And then when people meet someone who's pushy because they look at 12 steps as a religion, unfortunately, Rahman al-Litzalan, and they start to push this stuff, instead of by attraction, they try to promote, because they live their lives trying to promote Yiddishkeit and save the world and save every other Jew and make every other Jew like them and be frum and this and that. So then once you bump into a program guy or gal who gets infected with that kind of a way, they switched their addiction to religion into an addiction to recovery, and they become dogmatic in their recovery stuff. They turn those people off like you would not believe. And then those people become embittered people who scoff at people who share program in an open way and say, well, you obviously believe your way is the only way. I know, because you believe your way is the only way. That's why you believe that I believe my way is the only way. That's why. And the people who say, those kind of folks often answer, no, I'm the open-minded one here, and then it becomes a little petty argument. But you know, the untrustworthy are usually the most suspicious themselves, because, you know, that's the way we work. And so I'm trying to go past all that stuff. I'm trying to recognize it and go past all that stuff by just sharing the stuff that it says in the white book and in my experience in SA. Just as an SA member sharing his recovery, I don't speak for SA. That's very important for me to keep mentioning. And you know, with whoever wants it, you know. So one of the things that it says in the white book is that Roy says that he learned love kills lust, and lust kills love. So it behooves me as a recovering person to be curious about what Roy means by that, and why he would come to such a belief. Why does he say that that is so? What does that mean? You know, what does that even mean? You know, why would he say that lust kills love and love kills lust? So my sponsor would often ask me, are you on vacuum mode or blower mode today? You know, are you on the take, or are you on the give? Are you giving today? Rav Dessler writes about this in the Kuntres HaChesed that I keep referring to, which is sort of the yesod of everything in 12 steps, is being a giver or being a taker. But being a giver means that, but the reason for that is, even though the third step is the core of the program, obviously, everything revolves around it. If you look at the 12 steps as like a clock, sort of, the instead of 12 handles, there are really 11, you know, handles, and the 12 is that dot in the middle. Everything brings back to the third step. Everything. So, and I can explain that when we talk about steps, perhaps at some time in the call. But basically, on a simple kind of level, the first step is admitting that I'm unable to enjoy alcohol or lust like a normal person can enjoy those things. I go overboard. For them, it's maybe a sin, or maybe it's not. For me, it doesn't matter if it's a sin or if it isn't. Even if it were a mitzvah, even if masturbation and porn were a mitzvah, theoretically, I would ruin my life using those things. I don't know how to enjoy that stuff properly. And I've proven that over and over and over by hiding, creating a double life, lying, expending, misusing these sexual gifts, you know, the gift of sexuality. I misuse it in self-destructive ways. And then I excuse myself by saying, well, if only it would be mutter, I'd be happy. You know, if only society would allow these things, I'd be happy. If only my wife wouldn't care so much, then I would be happy. And it's lying. It's lying. I'm destroying myself, and I know it. And it's not because it's wrong, al pi halacha. It's because I'm destroying myself. I'm tearing myself to pieces, you know. And that's the problem with my drug, whether it's alcohol, heroin, cocaine, gambling, raging, lusting, whatever you discover, food, whatever you discover your drug of choice is, your power greater than yourself that restores you to insanity is, that's the problem with the capital P. I am a person who cannot enjoy this thing, which often is a possibly healthy or maybe not so healthy, but okay, neutral, normal thing that people do once in a while, at least. I destroy myself with it. Okay, for me, it becomes a power greater than myself that restores, that brings me to insanity, and the excuses abound, like I started to describe some. But that's the first step. The second step is coming to believe that I'm actually not going to be able to save myself from this. And I need a power greater than myself. I've been turning to God, the Rabbanu Shel Olam, all along, crying to him, please help me. And it didn't work, which is why you're here. So if you're an addict. So I need a power greater than myself that can actually restore me to sanity. Not just sobriety, but sanity. I'm screwing my life up by my acting out. I need a power greater than myself. I can't do it myself. I'm not God. I cannot do it. That's the core of step two. And my vision of God, of the Rabbanu Shel Olam, is obviously not working for me. So I need to understand the Rabbanu Shel Olam, or let's just call it God for easier purposes. I need to understand my higher power in a different way than I do if I'm going to be able to plug into him and it's going to work. Because everything I've used, everything I understand about how he wants me to stop and why, what he wants me to be mitaken and this and that, it has only led me into acting out even more. So, therefore, something's got to change. And through experience with other people who are sober and who are living life on a different basis and who were sometimes worse than me, sometimes better than me, but now living life without the drug at all affecting them in any negative way or shape or form, whether they're doing it through happy abstinence, comfortable abstinence, or through learning how to function with it or whatever it is. Whatever it is, whether it's 12 steps or whether it's therapy or whether it's something else, I come to believe that a power greater than myself really can actually restore me to sanity. Whether I understand it or not is irrelevant, but I come to believe that it really is true and accept that. And that can't come from a sefer that says, Hashem can do anything. Oh, then I believe, you know, because it says he's called Yachol, so I believe. No, it has to come through some kind of an experience, an actual experience that any human being can have, and it's not monopolized by Jews, obviously. As soon as it's monopolized by Jews, it's trash, because look at the membership of SA worldwide, you know? Look at the membership of SA worldwide. Every place where there's a Jewish community, it's growing faster than any other fellowship. There are more from Jews in SA meetings in every single country, area where there are from Jews than any other single group. So we've got it the worst, that's for sure. It's the worst of all the goyim, of all the nations, we've got it the worst. Porn, sex, lust, prostitution, phone sex, all the whole thing, you hear it over and over and over. And the more deeply from what the outside world would say, ultra-Orthodox, the community is, the more screwed up it is. Not it is, but many of the people are in this problem. The deeper we've sunk than other people. So there's a reason for that. I'm not criticizing Judaism or Yiddishkeit or the Jewish community. This is not a criticism. It's just a statement of fact that we need, to face up to that and to appreciate it in the proper way. So a power greater than ourselves that actually can restore us to sanity this time, not to sobriety, but to sanity is what's necessary. The sobriety will come as a result of sanity. You know, long-term sobriety will come, as it only really comes as a result of sanity restoration, not more willpower. That's clear. So those are the things. That's how I just understand powerless and unmanageability. The third step says, the core of everything is being at one with my God, putting myself comfortably into his care, accepting him as the one who cares for me, which I mentioned before in yesterday's call and in a few calls already, what I mean by his care and why his care is different than his Torah and his mitzvahs. What do I mean by that? Are they mutually exclusive, chas v'shalom? But what's his care? So I explained yesterday, I tried to share yesterday a little bit about how, or a few days ago, whatever it is, about a little bit about, how very simply, how does God demonstrate his will in my life? In Torah and mitzvah issues, and how does God demonstrate his will in my life in Divrei Rishus? Which one's more? And if you look at it, you'll realize that it's that the way he expresses his will for you and guides your life in a Torah or a mitzvah venue, in a Torah and mitzvah, with regard to Torah and mitzvah issues, is infinitesimally small compared to how he expresses his life, his will in your life and his guidance in your life in Divrei Rishus. So if you understand that, then you understand what the third step's about a little bit better, I think. The problem with that is that we can't really do that properly. We come up with all this Helukim Barasa Adam Yashavim Bikshu Cheshbonis Rabim. We come into all these Cheshbonis and we do all this stuff and it doesn't work for us, because of character defects, because of defects of character. In other words, selfishness, arrogance, fear, pride, mainly pride and fear. Those are basically the core of pride and fear. So we can't do it. So come steps 4, 5, 6, 7, and then 8 and 9 further, to move us along the way so that we can get a third step, so that we can actually put ourselves successfully into God's care. And then the 10th step is a continuation of that. And the 11th step is focusing on our connection with God and praying only, you know, really begging Him only for asking Him for guidance. That's it, just guidance. Help me do Your will. Help me know Your will and be able to do it. And that's it. That's our only concern. And this is what the Shulchan Aruch refers to in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Siman in the Shulchan Aruch, where he says that kol ma'asecha yehi l'shem shamayim, in it from a Jewish perspective. That's exactly what step 11, which is step 3 in action, is really only all about. That's it. Is putting myself into God's care as my focus in life today and in everything that I do and in everything that happens to me, which is, again, 99% divrei rishus. That's where a Jew is in divrei rishus. Divrei mitzvah is a small, small percentage of that. So, and that's the way that, and that's the beauty, and that's beautiful, I think. But a little background noise there. But anyhow, then the 12th step is something else. Sharing it, you know, with others, and then applying the steps in all aspects of our lives, you know, and it mentions that we have had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. Fine. The point, though, is that they all refer back to the third step. The steps after step 3 are enablers to connect with God and to align myself with God's will and God's will for me. In other words, the life God is giving me, 99% of that is in divrei rishus, not in divrei mitzvah, obviously, and because that's the way He operates, obviously, if you look at it. And the steps before step 3 are bringing me to see that step 3 is relevant, that I can't really lead my own life. I fail miserably at trying to manage my own life. So it's only because of step 1. So if you don't have a step 1, if you're not an addict, you won't be able to relate to any of the steps at all, not the ones before and not the ones after properly. Now, you may come to a third step of your own because of your religious convictions, okay? If you read, you know, say for Hamaspik from the Rabbi Avraham, the son of the Rambam, which is much smaller than I think what he originally wrote it at or what he intended, or, you know, but if you read the beginning chapters there, you'll see how, you know, these ideas really of you know, yichud machshava, and what all this stuff means, he's pointing to the same ideas, you know, but for normal people. He's not referring to addicts, obviously, because nowhere in Chazal or in the Torah is addiction dealt with. Nowhere. You know, sinning's dealt with a lot, but addiction is not dealt with anywhere in Chazal, anywhere in the Torah. There are some remuzim of people, there are some stories of people who perhaps were addicts, but what halachas do we learn from L'mashal Rebbe Lozer ben Derdaya? Nothing. There's no L'maisa halachas learned from him. There's no Musar L'maisa that most normal people benefit from him. Yesh konar lama b'sha'a achas. Okay, it's true. It's all true. But what do we learn from him? Not much. You know, when's the last time you sat down and said, Haharim v'agvos, bakesh rachamim alai? And they said, oh, we can't because of, you know, arts t'mutena and this and that. Haharim t'mutena, you know, they're not... the sky and the earth, you know, and this and that, and you finally said, "Ena dover tliya ela bi," and lemaisa, how does that affect your life? You know, what does that mean, "Ena dover tliya ela bi," to you? You know, so to an addict, it's simple. 12 steps is 100% about accepting self-responsibility. That's what the 12 steps is 100% about to me. 100% about accepting responsibility for myself, finally, instead of blaming everybody else. My wife doesn't give me enough sex. She's not pretty enough. The Torah is too constrictive. The people are too nasty. Everybody around me is judgmental. What do you expect? The poor and the women are walking in the streets uncovered. What do you expect from a person? This, that, the other thing. I was brought up unfrum, so now I'm stuck with the ways I learned in the past. It's the Yetzer Hara is inside. It's all blaming, 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 blaming. You know, 12 steps is the answer to that. 12 steps says, do you have responsibility for yourself or not? Ain't a dover tzuluya ella b. Do you have responsibility for yourself, or are you going to keep blaming this on God? Are you going to keep blaming this on your wife? Are you going to keep blaming it on society? Are you going to keep blaming it on the internet, Rahman, you know, Yamach Shemai, and this and that? Is that what you're going to do, or are you going to accept responsibility on yourself? For yourself. And the irony of the whole thing is that so many people hear about the steps and they hear, powerless, I'm powerless. That means I don't bear any responsibility for anything that I've done. Wow. They're misunderstanding the entire direction and point of the steps that way. Total misunderstanding of what's going on. And then the question is, do they work the steps or not? Well, then, okay, then they're starting off maybe in a place which is a little confusing. But Lamaisha, they're accepting responsibility on themselves to actually change. Okay, I have no problem with that. I don't see why anybody else would, you know. But the many people who I've read that say that the Ikkar for them was the first step, and it showed them that they're not responsible for it, and therefore, you know, whatever. It's sort of like in a Christian way to look at it. I'm forgiven. You know, you're forgiven. And from a Jewish perspective, you know, we tend to look at that and say, like, how can you be forgiven for things you didn't even do yet? You know, and like, you know, but that's the spirit of it. You know, kind of like, oh, you're all forgiven. It's not your fault. It's all not yours. You don't understand what you're doing, and therefore, it doesn't really matter. Oh, so you see, God does love me. You know, that's not the Jewish journey that, you know, typically it doesn't seem, but that seems to be what people, you know, from people all over the place, I've read and heard and, you know, are looking at the steps as. So they're missing the point. This point of the steps is 100% self-responsibility, taking responsibility for myself. So that's kind of the, you know, so again, lust kills love, love kills lust. What do I really mean? What does Roy mean by that? I don't know. But what do I mean by that? When I hear that, I mean that for a person to lust after somebody means that they're using them. Okay? If I'm lusting after somebody, that means I'm using them. The woman in the street is dressing this way. What do you expect? She wants to be used. She's dying for it. She's wanting to be used. This and that, you know? It's like, what do you expect? The disgusting shiksa, ugh, tui. The more disgusting I make them, the more of an object they are, not a human being. And the less it becomes, I can't love them now. Love them. Give out. Shekhet to Shekhtenu. The Rabban Shalom wants you to love shiksas that walk by wearing practically nothing in the street. Chas to Shalom. No, you misunderstand the whole thing. David HaMelech says, Yichvar Hashem La'olam, Yismach Hashem B'ma'asav. He wants the Rabban Shalom to have nachas from every person he created, including the shiksas in the street. If you, Yankala, Moishala, you know, Kanala, all of you would have been brought up as her, in her family. Would you be any better? Oh, yeah, I'm a Ben Torah. But you wouldn't have been a Ben Torah. You would have been brought up in her family. If you would have been put into her, we say every day, Shalo Osani Goy, Shalo Osani, you know, this, Shalo, if you would have been put into her family and brought up seeing the things that she saw, you might have been far, far worse than she is. So this is where the confusion comes in, where people say, oh, they're all sexaholics, all the goyim, they're all sexaholics, they're all dirty and disgusting, and that's, so of course there should be almost no goyim in like SA. That's why there's so many yidden in SA. That's not because we're so bad. It's because they're so bad, so they don't care. And it's like then they find out that Ruba Deruba of the membership still in SA is goyim. Like, why are goyim involved? Oh, because they're religious. No, not a lot of them are not religious at all. A lot of them are not religious at all. And you know what? Oh, because their problem is so much worse. No, actually, plenty of the goyim in SA, the majority of the goyim in SA, their problem is pornography and masturbation, not prostitution and raping people and child molesting and blah, 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 blah. Now, among the Firmiyidin who are in SA, it's not quite the same. Probably, I'd say, at least 50% the problem is prostitution and, you know, stuff that's a lot further down the line than just pornography and masturbation, which is a problem. That's a problem, you know. And part of the reason for that is certainly because we hide this stuff until it's too late, and it festers and gets worse and worse. So the shame causes it to become much worse than it needs to become, because Eden come to recovery and open up very haltingly, and it's way later than it needed to be. Didn't have to be this late. The disease has progressed even further than it needed to progress. So anyway, people come into recovery, and you know, so yes, Hashem does want us to love everybody. The midah of a tzaddik, which incidentally is the midah of Yesod, is achid shemaya va'aretz. The tzaddik joins shemayim va'aretz. Achid shemayim va'aretz. He makes shemayim and aretz join. That's the tzaddik. That's midas hayesod. Just like in the human being, it connects the man and the woman in the physical realm, you know, in a physical way. But in alpi kabbalah, alpi, you know, machshava and stuff, when you shake hands with somebody physically or, you know, like mentally, you agree to work on a project together with a fellow, whether it's at work, whether it's at, you know, in Yiddishkeit and, you know, Klal Yisrael, whether it's in your family, whatever it is, that's midas hayesod. That agreement to work together, the unification between two parties. In Kabbalah Shetok, they call them partsufim. But two parties, their agreement between two parties to work together to accomplish a totsa'ah that neither of them could have accomplished by themselves, that agreement to work together is the midah of yesod for every person in every situation as you go through your day. That is the midah of yesod. If a person understands that, then we understand why the midah of yesod is nota mostly toward, it has to have, you know, kedusha, hagdara, you know, lots of holding back, restraint, and this and that. You got to kind of hold back in a restraining kind of way in order to keep the boundaries kosher. There's got to be boundaries in that agreement midah. That yes, I'll agree to work with you, but you can't start doing my job, or I can't start doing your job. That requires hagdara, a certain amount of midas adin, you know, of you know, hagdara, and that's midas dvur, you know. But the purpose of it is for chesed, to create something in a positive, you know, in a creative, you know, thing. This is what the tzaddik does. That's the midah of tzaddik, which is yisod olam. That's the midah of tzaddik. He's ochid shemayim va'ara. He wants Hashem to have nachas from everything in the bria, and that's why David HaMelech talks about this in the Barchi Nafshi of Rosh Chodesh. He talks about it, you know, to a long, long way. He goes through all the brias, the sky and the earth and the shvanim and the animals that roar, and you feed them, and you have nachas from all the cute little bunny rabbits jumping around under the little slime, machsela shvanim, and it's delicious, and the bria is delicious and beautiful. Like the Shlach HaKadosh says in the beginning of Vayikra, if you look there, he talks about how Hashem has so much nachas from the Mishkan, because it's a cute little model of his world that he loves so much. You know, it's a model not of the tzaddikim of the gedolim. It's a model of the airplanes, the rocks, the trees, the chickens, the water flowing, you know, the gases, the elements, the stars, the galaxies. It's a model of everything. And Hashem is nachas. Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav. That's what the tzaddik wants to do. Wants to join Shemayim v'ara. Hashem, look, I want you to have nachas from your bria. How do you do that? Lemaisa, by helping everything in the bria enjoy its be aware of its connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So what am I going to do for the shiksa walking in the street? Who's a goya? What am I going to do? Try to put tefillin on her? Try to get her to get her to be a Jew? Try to get her to believe in Torah's Moshe? You know, and talk to her and yell at her, you know, stop dressing on sneers. She doesn't understand any of those things. She doesn't understand those things. The Baal Shem Tov said that you got to serve Hashem from where you are. You can serve Hashem from where you are. And the Maggid put it differently. The only place you can serve Hashem is from where you are, right now, right now. Not where you should be, right now where you are. They're not going to understand any of these things. What can I do to connect them to Shemayim? So yesterday I talked about the Chazer, and if you relate properly to something, then you help it, you're contributing to it turning back into the right thing in the time of Tikkun Olam. But this is at a different phase. So that's how, you know, we don't eat Chazer, and if we're marking from Chazer properly, so then it helps that thing have a Tikkun. In terms of people and relationships and stuff, fixing the same guys that you'll see complaining about the shiksas in the street with the lust and what do you expect and they're disgusting and here and there, the same guys are the ones that are judgmental at home, trying to fix their children, trying to fix their wife, fixing everybody around them, fixing the guy in shul who's talking too much, fixing this guy, fixing that guy. Everything needs to be fixed and people make a mistake and I go over to the chazan and I tell him you didn't pronounce this right, here and there. And I have that taiva too. I understand what that's all about, you know. There's a guy in my shul, I talk about this frequently on the calls. He keeps saying, you know, he says, B'yom Rosh Chodesh Hazeh in Yavayavo when he davens by the Yomid, and it's Rosh HaChodesh Hazeh. And I know that my spiritual state can be judged clearly inside me by how much I feel the bren to go over to him in a nice way, of course, and tell him that, you know, you're saying it wrong. And you know, look at the stories of the tzaddikim. You correct a simple person who has good kavanas, you can ruin them. You can destroy it. You have to be very careful. Mesillas Yesharim says in Shaar Nekiyos, very careful that the good things that you do don't have bad totsaos for somebody else who's different than you are. You know? And I know that would have a bad totsaos for him because almost every time that I've corrected somebody, if I stop like patting myself in the chest and on the back and I maintain open-mindedness, I see that it's probably caused damage. It's probably caused this person to now be, instead of open, calm, flowing prayer, connecting to his God through his davening, he's probably now more self-conscious than he was before, instead of God-conscious. So you have to be very careful. So then what is the tzaddik? So looking at this other person, what can I do for her? Am I going to talk to her about Yiddishkeit or talk to her about sneas or talk to her? It's totally inappropriate for myself to go speak to the shiksas out there and try to fix. I would bring myself down by doing that. I'm not that kind of a grace tzaddik and stuff to be able to put myself intentionally like, you know, the disco Rebbe from Migdal Eder, who goes into discotheques and discotheques in Eretz Yisrael and used to in the 80s and helping the carve these people in the discos and stuff. I'm not that kind of person, okay? I can't do that, you know? So what can I do, Lamaisa? What can I do is, instead of hating her and spitting on her and putting her down because I am a judgmental person, even though I'm the one who's ogling her, and I'm the one who's taking her image home and masturbating with it, and I'm the one who's wishing for her and following her and wanting her, and then I curse her even more because look what she makes me do. Lack of self-responsibility, isn't it? Since I'm the one who tends to do that, what can I do? I can say, Yismach Hashem Amas of Tata, I hope that you do whatever is necessary so that you can have nachas from her, you know? I hope that you can do whatever is necessary that give her whatever it is that she needs to have the relationship with you that you want her to have. As soon as I say, help her become a tsunua, help her fix her evil, disgusting, midos, help her stop being such a, you know, a chazer, such a, help her dress and not be machshel other people. Oy. As soon as I say that, help her not be a choyte a machti. You know, as soon as I say that, I'm putting myself in God's place and I'm judging this other person in a stupid way. Even though it's corroborated by halachas of Isser and Heter and this and that, I've subsumed the role of judging this other person from my perspective, ignoring the fact that if I would have been brought up the way she was, I would certainly be far, far worse. I'd probably be a hooker. And then the guy says, well, she probably is a hooker. Guess what? Most, I work with goyim at my job. There's a lot of goyim who work there. Women and this and men and this. They're not, most of them aren't like that. You know, most of them aren't, you know, hooking at night. Most of them have 9-to-5 jobs. They want to have a stable marriage. They cry about the same things. And they just want to be left alone. Most people, you know. So not everybody. But most people really are quite a bit more normal than I think. The reason that guys, that especially from guys, put down these people and say they're all disgusting, why would they care, is because that makes it easier for us to fantasize about them. We create them in our image, you know, and that makes them a juicier target for our fantasy lust. As soon as I start to treat her like a human being and focus on Tzadik Achid Shemayim Va'ara. That's the direction that I want to go. I'm not a tzadik, and I may never become a tzadik, which is one of the gorgeous things, by the way, about certain understandings of what a tzadik is. And this, I may never become a tzadik, but God help me, I don't want to go in the opposite direction. I want to go in the direction of a tzadik. That's the direction that I want to go in my life, and I want to be Achid Shemayim Va'ara, and I want to say she has value to you, Ribbono Shel'olam. Why? Because you made her. You didn't make her choose all the things she did, but just like you made me, you made her. Just like I took responsibility for me to become from and for me to do this and da, 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 fine. So she's doing the stuff that she understands, and she's doing the things she feels she needs to do. Is she making the right decision? I don't think so. Is she making the wrong decision? Yeah, about this, that, and the other thing, fine. Enough with that. Enough with judging her as bad and this and that. Let me just say, she's your creation, Ribbono Shel'olam. She's your business. She's not my business. She's your business. I want you to have nachas. I wish you to have nachas from her. And I can pray for her. I can pray for her. You know? I can pray for her. In other words, instead of praying for myself to help me resist the desire to look at her image, help me resist, instead of praying for myself, which if you're here, you probably know doesn't really work in the long run, I can pray for her. Yeah, I've been explaining that the whole time. It's not for her, it's for the Ribbono Shel'olam. You want Hashem to have nachas from her. You know, if she were in a burning car dying, you wouldn't say, well, Malin, you know, Maridim Vlevena Malin, let her burn. She's screaming, begging on the wind. You wouldn't do that. You know she has a husband at home who's gonna be terribly depressed. Now, of course, if you're the kind of guy that says, oh, he's a guy, he's probably having sex with her sister or something at home. So who cares? He doesn't care about his wife. If that's the way you look at it, you're a bitter, delusional person. And I've met people like this, many people like this, that they don't say these things, but they harbor them in their hearts. Who cares? They're probably blah, blah, blah. You know, they're just animals anyway. You know, Baharaya, look at how they behave. And you're the one following this woman around the supermarket to get another look at her legs. You know, it's like, you know, you're the one who's looking at her nude pictures. You know, you're the one who's, you know, it's like, interesting. So that's who I am. That's who I need to recognize that. If I treat her like a human being, and I have the proper relationship with her, that she's one of the Maaseh Ribbono Shel'olam, me looking at her and enjoying her more and taking in stuff about her and all this stuff, that's destructive to me. That's abusing her. That's not what she's in the world for. She's not in the world for that purpose. Whether she recognizes it or not isn't relevant. Ribbono Shel'olam, help her recognize that you're God and have a right relationship, the relationship that you want her to have. Hashem wants all the goyim to believe in him. Didn't he do all the makos in Mitzrayim for the Mitzrim? Or did he do them for the Jews? Look at what the Torah says. He did them all for the Mitzrim. He kept the Jews in Mitzrayim until they were at Memtes Shari Tumah with this huge risk of Od Shah Achas, you know, and this, they would be. Why? He says why. I put the Jewish people at risk, and I let them get lower and lower and lower. Over that year, during the Makkos, the Jews were getting lower. So then why was he risking that? It's simple. Laman Yedu, who? Paro and Mitzrayim. Ki ein kamoni b'chol ha'aretz. You know? So the Paro and Mitzrayim should know. Hashem wanted Paro, v'naharu elecha kol ha'goyim. It says, la'os levo. Ki goyel rishon kak goyel achron. That's what he wants. You know? So then why does he care about the goyim? You see, he does. He wants them to have the relationship, proper relationship with him. So there's no sense in saying he doesn't care. So then the Mela, I can ask Hashem for these things and I can care. If I'm doing that and I speak that way, instead of carrying her around with me and fantasizing about her all day, I can actually pray for her in this fashion that I'm describing, then I won't lust after her. The lust for her will roll off my back, disappear, and be completely forgotten. And it works 100% of the time, every time. And I'm late. Which is 100% of the time, every time too. I'll tell you when. So that's love. Love means, to me, love means in this context, love means taking actions of love, having a proper relationship with the other person, the right relationship, making the relationship right, is what it means when it says love kills lust. When I love, then I don't lust. And when I do this with my wife, it works the same way. If I'm using her. I need to make me happy. I need to figure out how to excite her so that I become, that's using her. If I'm using her, then I'm asking for trouble because that's lusting. I'm making her a kli. It's partially using the other person. That's not loving. That's not giving. That's not loving. You know. So if I'm using her, then I'm gonna lust. And the more I dehumanize these people, the more I lust after them. The more I humanize them and accept the fact that they're creations of the Ribbono Shel Olam, like David says in Baruch Hinafshi, and I pray, Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav, that Hashem should have nachas from them. Not just that they should drop dead, burn in Gehenna so that they can have the din, and then Hashem will have nachas from them. That's another way to hate them. That's another way to absolve myself. That's pointing the finger. And then there's four more fingers pointing at me, right? When you point at somebody, so or three at least. So anyway, no. Achid Shemayavar. So when does this praying for another person that I'm lusting after not work? When it's the first thing that I do all the time, and I start looking in the street for women and paying attention to them in order to pray for them, that's fooling myself. The way that this praying for the other person works is, I see a woman in the street, she's none of my business. She's God's business. She's God's people. They're people that God made. They're his human beings. You know, they belong to him. She's not my business. Like one of the great guys on Guard Your Eyes used to say, you know, she's none of my business. You know, I don't remember the way he used to say it, but it was the Berdichever guy. She's none of my business, you know. So if I can remind myself she's none of my business, then I'll drop her, you know. And if I can't, if I make her my business, then I'm going to lust after her and I'm going to start using her because that's what I do. So I got to be honest with myself and, you know, get some help. But if I try to let go of her and I admit to myself she's none of my business, it's none of my business. How she looks, she's not mine anyway. I haven't, you know, called no saying ain't of Masha ain't of Shiloh, like I explained at the end of one of the calls in the first, or, you know, first week of this. Why does it work that way? Because you can't appreciate what you have when you when you're filled with desire for something else, because it always looks better. So you lose the joy in everything you have as a result of that. So if I'm lusting, I can't love. If I'm loving, I can't lust. They work opposite each other. If I'm on the give, I can't be taking. And the more fearful I am, the more I'm going to run away from the giving and start taking again. That's the way that we work. It's not natural for us to be giving, 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 concerned with accepting God's will, which is a giving attitude. You know, we want to hold things and grab onto them and control and control and make it work out the way we want more and more and more. That's on the take. That's not accepting God's will. You know, that's being on the take. So, anyhow, yeah, it's really late again. Sorry. But we did start quite a bit late, and at least it won't go over an hour for the recording session, people. So you have that choice, you know. If you try to let her go and ignore her and do the proper thing, you know, say, you know, I tried, you know, you say, well, you know, Hashem doesn't want me to be staring at this woman. Hashem doesn't want me to be taking this woman in. That's not why he made her. That's not why he made me. This isn't good for me. It's us or it's this, it's that. You say these things, they're good for us. They're the truth. And if they don't work, because I'm a lustaholic, because I'm a sexaholic, if it's not working, I try to let it go. I try to surrender. I try to let it go. And none of these things are working. Then as a last resort, praying for her. Now's the time to pray for her. Now's the time to pray for her. It's exactly in the same fashion as the Gemara that says, Gemara Brochus again, says, how do you fight the Yetzer? Rigzu v'al techeto. First fight it. Fight it. Fight it. If it doesn't work, then imra b'vavchen, learn Torah. If that doesn't work, learning Torah, so then al mishkavchem, say kriya shema. And if that doesn't work, v'domu sela, think about Yom HaMisa. So the question is, why don't you just think about Yom HaMisa? Because obviously that's the last one. There's no advice after that. Some of that's the best shot you've got. So why doesn't it say that first? Who needs the rigs of al-techeto? Who needs the rest of it? Just think about Yom HaMisa. As soon as you have the Yitzhar, think about Yom HaMisa, boom. So obviously some people can do that. But guess what? If you think about Yom HaMisa first, you're more likely, if you're not primed properly, you'll probably think of Yom HaMisa and react the way Esav does. What does Esav do when he thinks of Yom HaMisa? Hine anochi holech lamos, lamos ali b'chora. What do I need? You know, lama li b'chora. You know, what do I need the b'chora for? I'm going to die anyway. Who cares? Might as well go enjoy myself. What do I need this headache for? You know, it's just going to kill me. It's, you know, that's what thinking about Yom HaMisa does to someone who's not primed properly. So you have all this taiva, which is extreme self-centeredness. We're all incredibly self-centered when we're lusting and stuff. And then we go think about Yom HaMisa, it's just going to make us more lustful in the end, probably. You know, it's ridiculous. So it's not going to work. Praying for her as a first line of defense is not the way to do it. First, I have to really try to surrender. I have to take actions, make a phone call to somebody else and say, you know, I'm in the supermarket, I just saw a really pretty lady, and I don't want to feel like I'm listening to her voice the whole time, and now I have to walk down the frozen vegetable aisle to maybe hop another good look at her. I don't want to do that. I want to just let her go. I don't want to control myself and willpower and force it and win and win and win and bring the Mashiach and all this other crazy talk. I just want to be free. Please, I just want to be free. And the other guy, if he's a recovery guy and not some chachnokti guy, will say, oh, I relate so much. Thanks for sharing. I understand. Thank you so much. Your goodwill is such a big help to me. Thank you. Hatzlacha with that. Bye, and that's the end of the call. If on the other hand he says, oh, you better, it's important, Gevalt, oi, remember what it'll do to you if you follow her. You know, if he does that, then he's wasting your time and his time. But anyhow, so, and then you'll be fine if he, you know, just, you know, thanks for sharing. You know, I understand. And then you get off the phone. And if that doesn't work, so now it's time to pray for her. If you do the normal things, you really try to let it go, you show your priorities to let it go, and it doesn't work, now's the time to pray for her. Okay? So, because now's the time to focus on love. In other words, proper connection instead of lust. If you do that, you're going to be okay. You know, you're going to be all right. I hope this was useful. Sorry for being a little late, but it is under an hour still for those who are listening to the recording. I'll try to do better. Pray for me if you want. And everybody have a good day. Bye-bye.